Hi, welcome to episode 54 of Speaking of Mysteries. For more than a century, the grisly story of Jack the Ripper has captured the world's imagination. The tale has been told and retold countless times with varying degrees of success. With the recently published I, Ripper, Stephen Hunter, whose usual crime fiction stomping grounds are the faded denim noir neighborhoods of western Arkansas, turns his attention to Jack, and the newspaper men who did what they could to make him what he became. Here's Steve Hunter. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and our guest this time is Stephen Hunter, who has written I, Ripper. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you very much, Nancy. Glad to be here.
I have a lot of questions about this book, but before I ask specifically about the book, I wanted to ask you, there have certainly been serial murders before Jack the Ripper, and we know there have been a lot of them since, but what is it about Jack the Ripper that continues to fascinate us, in your opinion?
Yes, there's about four or five factors that combined have compelled him to our perpetual attention. One is the fact that he was the first of the mass media killers. He occurred at a time when London was the newspaper capital of the world. There were over 50 competing dailies, and he got massive coverage, which propelled him into the Western imagination when it wasn't used to this kind of saturation coverage. And I think that had part of it. I think another thing that had to do with them was the crimes themselves. They were very, very violent. They were unprecedentedly violent. As it turned out, all of the grievous bodily damage was affected post-mortem. He was not a torturer. He was a desecrator, and he mutilated his victims in horrific ways, culminating in the murder of Mary Jane Kelly, who was, you know, I mean, I can't even begin to describe what happened to her, although I make a game effort in the book. The third thing, great brand name. Someone, whether it was Jack himself, doubtful, probably a journalist, came up with the name Jack the Ripper. You know, next to Cracker Jacks and Babbo and Winston tastes good like a cigarette should, it's one of those extremely economic yet extremely poetic constructions that just clings. It penetrates to your subconscious so that even today, millions of people know nothing about Jack the Ripper, know nothing of Jack in history, of Jack in the London of 1888, Jack in Victorian times, but they know the phrase Jack the Ripper, and it conjures to them a skulker murdering prostitutes in a fog-bound area. And that is just something, it's such a primal image, and it's such a brilliant piece of naming that you can't get it out of your mind. And before I put you totally to sleep, I'll give you one more. And that is the fact that the crime was never solved. And that involves every writer, or that invites every writer from the most august to the most depraved to come up with his own ending. You get to sort of finish your story. After his fifth murder, Jack disappeared. And there's never any sense of the story being closed, of Jack being punished. And, of course, if you're a civilized person, you yearn for his punishment. And writers high and low have been providing endings for four generations now. And I'm merely the latest to come along with a snappy ending to this very bloody tale.
So that's, I take it, these 5 points are among the motivations for you to take a detour from Bob Lee Swagger to tackle Jack.
Yes, that's true. I'm not sure if I was tired of Swagger or Swagger was tired of me, but I always had a Jack bug. I acquainted myself with Jack. I'm not even sure when or how. I'm guessing it was in the 70s. I can't index it to wife or job or whatever. But somehow I acquired a glob of Jack knowledge, and I was always aware of new Jack theories. I was aware of Jack research. I knew there was a incredibly complicated and political Jack culture out there. I knew that he was in somehow the bottom of everybody's mind. And years later, I came up with an idea for a reveal in a pop novel, a Jack who would be unlike any other Jack. And it was extremely, on a bunch of different levels, it was very attractive to me. And, you know, I decided, I also like Victorian England, and I like the sort of it as the cockpit for the 20th century. I mean, you could see in nascent form all the ideas, all the plans that would reach harvest in the 20th century, which is still my century. I mean, I live most of my life in it, and it's still, its dramas are far more vivid to me than the dramas of the 21st century, which are just sort of hazy images on a TV screen. So the attraction to go to Jack was so intense, it was, it couldn't be resisted. I mean, whether or not I published the book, you know, was something I would deal with after I wrote it. I just knew that I had to write it. It took me a long time to figure out how to structure it. But it was always, you know, that my subconscious was working even when I was, you know, on my seventh beer watching the Orioles lose yet again. Somehow a certain tiny percentage of my brain was trying to figure out how to tell this Jack story. And when I figured it out, there was just no stopping me. And no commercial. In fact, here's a scoop for you. The way my contract is set up, I get a bonus, a very nice financial bonus for every Bob Lee Swagger novel, because Bob Lee sells books. People love Bob Lee. So this is unbelievably idealistic of me. Gives you some idea of how important this book was to me. I forego that bonus and wrote the book for bottom dollar.
I have to talk a little bit about because you mentioned it, the unique structure of this book. You toggle between two narratives, and the voices are very, very different. It's hard enough to develop the voice of one character, but to completely develop the voice of two, both written from first-person perspectives. Was that a difficult feat, or is it just, was your brain able to switch back and forth with
these? You know, it turned out to be surprisingly simplest, mainly because I'm shameless and fearless and possibly too shallow to consider the ramifications of the task I set out to do. I didn't set out to give, I tried to give them voices that were familiar in, that were similar in, you know, in structure, in erudition, in wit, in acquaintanceship with classical learning. Yet, I, you know, one was insane and the other wasn't. And I'm not quite sure how I did it. You know, I can't remember. It's not like I had guidelines per character. I just, you know, sometimes the only way to do something is to do it. And I did it. And it turned out the way it turned out, for good or bad, is a decision I won't make. But somehow, at some point, it became so that the voices felt very natural to me. And I have to say that after spending so much time in sort of parts Bob Lee Swagger arroyos and, you know, back alleys and desert towns and jungle glades, it was nice to be, it was very pleasing for a certain part of me to be in salons and in, you know, in restaurants and in the company of people who spoke in complete sentences and even knew how to punctuate as they spoke. But I felt very, I quickly came to feel at home there. And I wish I could relate agonies and nightmares and writer's dilemmas. And none of those occurred to me. The book just sort of came out of me in two spools that wove together neatly, I thought. And it happened the way it happened, and it happened relatively painlessly and relatively professionally. And there's a whole other story, which I won't tell, about the tribulations of getting it through the New York publishing mills. But the book, you know, I ended up with the book that I wanted in print, and writing the book I wanted was one of the great pleasures of my life. I mean, I've been lucky in the last several books I've written, I've really enjoyed writing. And I've written some books where I thought, God, do I have to go back to this thing tonight? You know, but it was only, you know, it was the only book I had. So yes, I did have to go back to it. Fortunately, Dr. Budweiser and Dr. Bourbon were around in those cases to nurse me through my ordeal.
Yes, many of us have called on services.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, as an author yourself.
Of those august physicians. one thing that struck me, you mentioned it in when you were talking about what was so compelling about the story, but you really brought it out in Eye Ripper, is the symbiosis between Jack the Ripper as this character and the press. And you know, if notoriety was one of the goals of Jack the Ripper, and judging by his actions, I would guess that it was, he needed the press to go along. But at the same time, you're not very kind to our ink-stained predecessors.
No, I'm not. I looked at length at the papers of the era. They were exquisitely written. They were probably far better written than ours are. For a far more literate population than ours is, and a far more educated population than ours is, but they understood the primal impulse of journalism, which is if it bleeds, it leads. And even the best papers in the country understood that Jack sold papers, and that somehow they had to sell papers. That was their reason for existence. And so even the London Times and even the Pall Mall Gazette and even all the papers that you associate, the great Victorian papers, dipped their hands in the blood Jack unleashed and pushed Jack hard. And Jack was also a worldwide phenomenon. We here in America followed Jack very carefully because Jack was extremely interesting to us. And as I mentioned, as I document in the book, there was an American reporter. There was a guy named Harry Dam who was very much a pivot or a cog in the big journalism machine. He worked for the Star. The Star was the leading paper, I guess you would call it the New York Daily News of London. It was a paper that had sensationalist aspirations, and under the energy and guidance and perhaps immoral practices of Harry Dam, the Star sold millions of copies off of Jack's bloodlust. It was also, what was so much fun for me was, you know, I was a newspaper man, or I was a newspaper figure for 38 years. And I came into the newspaper game when it was still a game, pre-computers, way back in hot metal days. And I remember the pneumatic tubes that sent the copy down to the composing room. I remember the smell of melted lead in the composing room. And I remember the intricacy of putting together a hot metal newspaper and locking the press pages, you know, which were linotype on lead slugs, assembled like a jigsaw puzzle and locked in a frame. And that's what was printed. And it was, you know, it was an incredibly interesting. There was something about it that was so cool that I think we lost when we went the way of the computer.
And I'd like to add, all of this done backwards.
Exactly. So it was fun for me to kind of relive that and get old newspaper stuff into the book. I was sort of a secret candy that I was nibbling on as I wrote, and using terminology that I hadn't heard in my mind in 35 years. It was great fun.
Well, in addition to that great fun, I think you also had a bit of fun, and I'm assuming it was lighthearted, at the expense of Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes, and John Watson, as well as a bleak shout-out to Tolkien and Thomas Harris, the creator of Hannibal Lecter. Care to comment on that?
Well, I love Thomas Harris, and his portrait, his image of a killer is haunting and resonant, and I mean the fact that he's tumbled some primal chord is obvious in the fact that not only have his books been made into movies, but some of them have been made into several movies and TV series as well. So those stories really are deep in our psyche, and anyone who's going to play in that game has to be aware of what he's done and has to, you know, you either have to sort of make friends with it or make enemies with it, but you've got to have an attitude towards it. And one of my problems with him, I mean, I love him. I don't mean in any way this should dissuade no one from buying even more of his books. But one of the things that seems to me wrong about his is that he makes the killer too romantic and too interesting, so that we sort of forget that he's a killer and we see him primarily as the driving narrative force in a narrative. You know, we're always drawn to the active rather than the passive within the framework of narrative. So I wanted Jack. I wanted his squalor. I wanted his. I wanted what he did recorded instead of poetically alluded to. So my Jack, I have a slightly different theory of madness than Harris's. My theory is moral vanity. He felt he was doing something for the good of the world. And that's what drove him, the sort of sense of being a deliverer of mankind. That zealotry is what was secretly driving him, as opposed to Hannibal, who understands what he's doing is wrong, but finds it intellectually so delicious, he can't stop doing it. It's just like he loves the game, and he loves sort of understanding principles of behavior in forensics and criminology that law enforcement doesn't, and he loves outsmarting law enforcement. Jack, my Jack at least, is believes that he is some sort of Nietzschean moral being whose ultimate impact will be for the good of the world rather than the back of the world. So in that sense, I thought of him as being psychologically different than Hannibal, but having Hannibal as a baseline was, in the end, probably very helpful for me. It gave me sort of a whole area not to go into that kept me organized in the area that I had decided to be in. Does this make any sense at all?
Oh, yes, it does. Yes, it does. Good. And I think the use of the word delicious is particularly appropriate when referring to...
Thank you so much. And the other thing I must say I love about... I don't read a lot of thrillers. I'm not a thriller guy. I'm not a guy who picks up with the other guys. So I'm not really sure what they're doing and what the state of the art of the business is. And that's a choice I've made. But one of the reasons that I won't mention any names, several of the writers who are very successful and very highly regarded, in my mind, write very poorly. And I can't get beyond that. And what I do like about Thomas Harris is he writes exquisitely well without any strain or, you can feel the UPI newsman in him demanding that he keep it clear and the sentence direct and that everything, and he just has such a narrative gift that everything flows and there's never any horror of cliche that leaps out, knocks you over the head, and kicks you out of the book. That's why, in another sense, that's what I aspire to, and that's what I admire about him, and it's one of the reasons I read him, and it's what I hope is guiding my work. But I think, for me, having Thomas Harris as an ideal, I think that's helped me very much.
When you're talking about sort of literary inspirations, we can talk about your character, Jeb, and without any spoilers, as he encounters, Jeb, and I mean, as he encounters Jack and as he covers him, some of what transpires is inspirational. And so I have to ask, do you see yourself with a sequel in the offing about Jeb's career? Perhaps Jeb can encounter Earl Swagger. Or are you going back to Bob Lee?
When I started Bob Lee, the first Bob Lee book, I had no idea that I would end up, chronicling through 10 books a family saga of Western Arkansas. I mean, you could have, I would have laughed in your face if you had told me that's what they had. It was time to put it down. Now it's time to pick it back up. And so for any Bob Lee fans who are out there angry at me because I abandoned him for a while, rest assured, Uncle Steve is busy, 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 and probably will return, and I think I found a way to do something that I think will be a lot of fun for me. The books have to be fun. There's too much work not to be fun. If I have to choose between fun and success, I'll choose fun. I think I could write a best-selling novel about a spunky gal detective and her mentor as they're searching for a paid assassin from Big Tobacco. I think that's that would be a book that would sell 10 million copies. But I couldn't write it. It's just beyond me to write it. It would just turn my life to horror. And it would make me even, more misanthropic and cranky than I am now. So I will always go the way that is most enticing to the pleasure centers of my mind and the things that I do well and that I enjoy doing well. Like, I love gunfights. I love to write gunfights. I love tough old geezers with 45 automatics who, can read a crime scene better than anyone else. I like that. I like guys of 30s. I like a whole era of what someone called the frayed denim of American noir. And that's, I saw that line describing my work in a British review, and I thought, yeah, that's it. I get it. That's exactly what I like. And so I will be turning to that. I don't know if I'll ever do, another English Tweed book again. I love English literature. I love English culture. I love English Tweed. But this was kind of it. It was such a great pleasure. It's time to move on. And this business has got to keep moving on, finding new ways of doing things you want to do. So that's my mission at the time. That's my mission at this time.
Well, you touched on something, and that is firearms, and your knowledge of firearms is encyclopedic, and I think that that's true. So, once again, this isn't really a spoiler, but I was curious what it was about the howdah, and I'm assuming I'm pronouncing that correctly, that made it the weapon of choice for this story. There's only one firearm in this story.
Okay.
That's
a good question. I haven't had that one. The howdah is a kind of a cult gun. Everybody who sees it loves it. I don't even know if it was ever used for the purpose it was used. But everybody, you know, if you get gun people together and you get enough alcohol into them, mention the howdah, and they will light up. Because it's such a sort of outrageous, creative, and bizarre weapon. And it also tracks back to a nostalgic sort of area of gun culture, which is hunting in Africa before environmentalism was invented. And so no one had to feel guilty about it. And it was hunting was a expression of imperialism and colonialism. It harkens to a period when we white people believed that we were God's golden chosen people and that we were bringing civilization to the natives. Well, you cannot express that view seriously these days. You can only refer to it ironically. And there's a lot of pleasure and a lot of sentimentality for that kind of lost Camelot, a lost gun Camelot of big game hunting and safari hunting in Africa and India, British, obviously. And I'm at least, as I say, fearless and shameless enough to acknowledge its appeal and to understand that when I put that gun in there, I'm touching the chord that most of my readers won't hear, but a certain percentage will respond to in a very sort of profound way. My one disappointment in using it was I didn't get a chance. Maybe here's a spoiler. I shouldn't even give it away, but to be honest, I have to. Jack the Ripper isn't killed by howdah. When you see howdah, you say, uh-oh, that's exactly and precisely the weapon that should dispatch Jack. Because he was, after all, a tiger. He jumped out of the trees and he climbed into the cockpit on the elephant and he ate white people in their lair where they felt they were safe. And that was in London. So metaphorically, how that now strikes me would have been the perfect weapon to dispatch him. But I came up with something even more fiendish and more sacrilegious and more blasphemous. So I am pleased with Jack's, with what happens to Jack at the end of I Ripper. And I accept and am at peace with the fact that although there is a howdah, it was not the weapon that sent him to his next destination.
No, but I knew when I read that there was more significance to the choice of the weapon than it was, you know, the first thing in the gun cabinet when you opened it, and that's why I wanted to ask the question.
Well, I will say, researching it, looking up its usage, its caliber, describing it, all that was great fun. I mean, it was obvious. If anything, it was a treat I gave myself. And it was also, in a way, it was a kind of way of reaching out to young people who were dismayed by that point in the book that there's no interest in guns in the book. And suddenly, here's the howdah, which they will know of and perhaps be as delighted about as I will.
And my last question, which I think you've answered, but I still want to ask it. What's more fun, writing crime fiction or reviewing films?
Oh, reviewing films was so fabulous for so long. But that was when the baby boom was at the center of the marketing strategy, and the films were designed to play on baby boom vanities and narcissism and intellectual processes and tropes and themes. In other words, the movies were aimed exactly at me because I was baby boom cusp. I was right at the, I was born in 1946. I was at the center of baby boom culture intellectually and culturally and emotionally for 60, you know, well, for 40 years or whatever. But at a certain point, we baby boomers lost our market pull, our clout. And the movie started to be engineered towards younger and younger people. And I understood at a certain point that they were no longer speaking to me. And I had to make a decision whether to fake it, to pretend to be a Generation Xer or a millennial, or to stay a baby boomer. And I knew if I stayed a baby boomer, I had to fire myself as a film critic. And that essentially what happened was, yes, I did get fired. The person who fired me was me. The Washington Post was perfectly content with me, and they had no problems. Among other things, I was a superb technician. I always got this on time. It required minimal work. It had a following. It was part of the community perception of the Post, and the voice was appropriate for the style section. But for me, it was no longer fun. I'm such a sybarite that everything I do has to be fun. And it was just becoming more and more laborious. And so I, when a offer came along, a generous offer, a totally generous offer, because they were trying to get rid of the high-paid older talent. So the only way to get rid of high-paid people is to offer them money. And I just barely qualified for it by 6 months, having been at the paper for 10 years. And I took the money and ran. And it was, you know, I missed the golden days of the importance of the baby boomer film critic. But I know that it's gone forever. It's a Titanic that sunk. And I managed to get into a lifeboat. And I sort of pointless to miss it because it doesn't exist anymore. There's nothing there to miss. Now, it's not like the party is still going on, only I'm now not invited. The party has been shut down. The party disappeared by an iceberg called age. And so I don't miss film criticism at all. I'm able to give myself now completely to the books. That is when I'm not sleeping, drinking, or shooting.
Well, that is a brilliant point to end this interview.
Thank you very much.
And I want to thank you again for joining us and talking about Eye Ripper. And also to make sure that all the Bob Lee Swagger fans know that he will be back.
Yes.
Frayed or faded denim noir will continue in the life of Steve Hunter.
I am going to eagerly go shoot, then drink, then sleep. So it's been a very good day for me.
Okay, thanks again.
Thank you, Nancy.
Speaking of Mysteries, next interview is with Robert Rothstein, who's The Bombmaker's Son, the third of his Parker Stern series of mysteries, is being published on June 9th. Until next time, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.